Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. Here we go.
Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
It's ladies' night.
Yeah.
Let's celebrate.
Yeah.
Wanna get down on it?
Yeah.
Oh, wrong James Taylor.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
My name is Sugar.
Yeah.
I'm the engineer.
Yeah.
And I love great music.
Yeah.
That's why I'm here.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
My name's Boss Bill.
Yeah.
And I ain't no sucker.
Yeah.
What are we doing?
Yeah.
Roll call, brother trucker.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema. Roll call.
Nice one.
Suprema. Suprema. Roll call.
It's Laia.
Yeah.
And James Taylor.
Yeah.
I ain't no lame.
Yeah.
No fire and rain.
Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
I'm James.
Yeah.
I came up here today.
Yeah.
I guess I'm here for good.
Yeah.
You know, I'm ready.
Roll call. Suprema.
We'll take it.
Suprema roll call.
Suprema roll call.
Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
Nice. All right, we got through that.
Just barely.
I know, right? Ladies and gentlemen, we have less than an hour to unravel the complex artistry of over 50 years. That is our guest today and probably one of my favorite singers ever. I'll just say on a personal note, to be selfish on the show that has my name in it, James Taylor is... His voice, in my opinion, is probably hands down, I believe, one of the most beautiful, soothing, warm sounds that I can recall. It's kind of my trusted blanket. You know, it's a favorite uncle, my favorite teacher in school. And this is coming from a guy who also thinks that HR from Bad Brains is equally... as soothing. I'm sorry.
But wow. I'm going to take it as a compliment. Anyway, I am.
Yeah, James Taylor in HR, man. I'll be the first to admit that, I'm probably the only media personality that doesn't care if that song was about you.
She's already said that it wasn't about him.
Well, I know. Yeah. But, mainly because I think I pegged it in my head with a voice that's soothing. I'd never bothered to even look under the hood. I don't know if I subconsciously didn't want to look under the hood because it's just like, that's my trusted blanket. And in the week and a half of preparation that I decided to search under the James Taylor hood, yikes. I was wrong. And, you know, his newest book, Breakshot, or his audiobook.
Audiobook, yeah.
Breakshot.
Audible exclusive.
Yes, on Audible exclusive. It's a must read. For every artist I ever work with, this is literally like, I'm not even separating myself. It's probably I needed this too. It dissects the first 21 years of his life, and which is... kind of an understatement to say is a rather dark journey, which now really has me to the point where I'm just obsessed with entertainers or comedians or actors or whoever that managed to ruse me in a way of like, ladies and gentlemen, James Taylor's here. All right, everyone's looking at each other like,
yeah, man.
It's like we've only got an hour.
We got 51 minutes left.
I hear his voice.
Thank you for coming on the show. You know how special this is? Zare is here.
Yeah.
And it's not even a political figure. Zare, one of my managers, is only here whenever someone's here to discuss politics. So
Roman Farrell and Chris Hayes. That's it. That's it, Jay.
This is out, especially, you know, if she's in the room watching.
All right.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. You know, it's like a we've got a couple of projects that are coming out at the same time, and a tour starting up in April. So, you know, it's a very it's a busy season, and it's kind of a promotional season, you know, and where you take your stuff to market. And that's always been, you know, that's always been a kind of a difficult passage for me. Where you make a project, you know, in this case, it took us a couple of years to make this album. And then you take it by its little hand and lead it into the marketplace, you know, and launch it. Mm-hmm. And that's always a confusing process, but it's one that I've gotten used to. And not only that, it's become much, much better as time has gone by. I'm talking to people almost completely who I admire and respect, and that makes all the difference, you know. I mean, back in the beginning, you'd sort of go to Rolling Stone and hope that some intern who was interviewing you, cutting her teeth on your project and reviewing it. Mm-hmm. That could be really just made it a daunting kind of a process, you know, to get into. I've been feeling really good about this particular project and the people I've met and talked to about it.
So you're saying that even this late in the game, when you create product, you still go through the process of its critical reception, it's how it fares well with your fan base and whatnot. You still have those?
Absolutely. It's still a part of the work. It's where you, you know, music used to happen. It used to happen in the street, and it used to happen on the farm. But it used to happen in the church and in the court, you know, those were or in academia somehow, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that having music exist in a commercial context where it's saleable, mm-hmm, is a better choice. That's better than the court or the church, in my opinion. It's not better than essentially folk music, which is sort of free. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely a step in the right direction to have it, to take it to market in order to get people to hear it.
So when you're in your formative years, at least for like your first five or six albums, are you obsessively looking to see, do you take a Lester Bangs seriously, or even a Krista Gall, or I'm trying to figure out who was the Pitchfork of his day, like the critic that, or John Landau.
John Landau or Hillman out in Los Angeles. Or
Robert Hillman, yeah, yeah.
Right. Yep.
So that would mean something to you?
Absolutely. I mean, just in as much as it either pushes the project along and gets it out there for people to hear, or it doesn't. That was always the priority. In fact, I made such ruinous deals and decisions early on, mostly due to bad advice, that I never really saw records as a source of income. They never were. So I always just looked at it as a way to support touring, and also as a way to just get my thing out there, to get my art out there.
Wow, that's weird to hear. Because I thought I was the only artist that was record sales, whatever. Like, when we tour, that's how I make my money. And the record store, like the flyer that you advertise, hey, I'm coming to town, that sort of thing.
Well, it's also the medium that we work in. If you're a recording artist, and I think that's something I've gotten better at over time. I cringe when I listen to my early stuff, but But over time, I've gotten better at recording and gotten closer to what I hear in my mind when I, you know, when I think about a tune.
I'm just curious, what James Taylor album makes you cringe?
Yeah, I'm kind of concerned. I'm like, oh, please don't let it be one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like for you, like, what's your like, yeah, what album that every fan like, oh my god, and you're just like, whatever.
Well, the first one, the one,
okay. The Apple record.
Yeah, the Apple record. Okay. Yeah.
But even then, it's like, if I recall correctly, you've spoken a few times that, you know, you were creating that right when the Beatles were creating
the White Album, yeah.
White Album, correct? So,
like, whenever the Beatles weren't at Trident Studio, you were there.
That's right. Bill, we were.
They let you race the board and just.
Yeah, they did. I guess. There weren't digital cameras in those days, so you couldn't take a picture of it and expect to have it the next day.
Right.
But a Polaroid, I guess.
Yeah.
But I never actually thought about that, man.
Did you realize that you were in the eye of probably the most celebrated creative storm in music history?
I did. I was aware of that in a sort of, but, you know, in those days I lived, you know, a day at a time, maybe a week at a time. I didn't really expand beyond what was sort of in the room, you know. It seemed surreal to have been, you know, a year prior to that, I'd been here in New York and my band had failed and I'd sort of limped back to North Carolina to lick my wounds and, you know, and then, lo and behold, a year later, I'm auditioning for Paul McCartney and George Harrison. So it was on one level unbelievable, but but you know, I just accepted it as what was happening now. You know,
how did even word about you get to Paul and George? Were you the first artist signed to Apple?
Okay, I was the first artist signed, And my lucky break was that my main partner, actually through most of my musical life, has been a guitarist from New York, lives in Los Angeles now, named Danny Korchmar Cooch. And Cooch had backed up Peter and Gordon, a sort of British invasion group like Chad and Jeremy. Mm-hmm. They had World Without Love was a song of theirs, and... Knight in Rusty Armor, you know, sort of a British novelty duo, you know, okay. very much British invasion sort of mold. But and then the year after that, I had been in the band with Cooch here in New York. So I called Cooch after I got to London. I said, have you still got a number for Peter Asher? And it turned just thinking that he might have some contacts in the music business in London. And as it turned out, he had just signed on as head of A&R for this brand new label that the Beatles were starting, Apple Records. So he was basically looking for people to sign, and it couldn't have been
better timing.
It couldn't have been better timing. It was just, you know, it really threaded the needle, and the window was very short. For, you know, I was signed. Billy Preston was signed. Mary Hopkin. Mm-hmm.
Modern Jazz Quartet.
Yep. MJQ.
MJQ was on Apple?
Yeah.
Apple, really?
Yeah.
Damn, son. Okay.
That's amazing. I didn't realize that. A group called Badfinger and a guy named Jackie Lomax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the five or six or seven acts that were signed within the 10-month period that Apple was actually open to other people. That is to say, before Alan Klein came in and just shut it down. Mm-hmm. It was, I'm sure it was hemorrhaging money, but I'm also sure that it was just a unique opportunity, you know, and they gave me that first chance. Wow. So that's how I ended up. I got my little demo reel-to-reel tape to Peter Asher. I played him a number of songs, and he said, "Let's go up and see if we can play this for a Beatle, up at."
For a Beatle.
I love how casual that just comes out. You know, it's like, yeah, let's just see if a Beatle's here.
And the way Peter remembers the day, we we went up to, I got my guitar in my little cardboard case, and I follow him up to this building in Baker Street in London where their temporary first offices were. And he sort of installs me in a room and says, "Is there a beetle in the house?" You know, leans out into the hall. And
that's amazing. That's amazing.
That's good management.
And I say it's as Peter remembers it, because I myself, the whole day is just like a blur. Yeah. I mean, I was like made for 110 and plugged into 220. You know, I was totally shocked. You know.
Well, okay, we brought up Peter Asher, who's such a, at least I consider, I mean, would you say that Asher is like one of the Mount Rushmore figures of what I think of when I think of the California sound or
definitely
that. So what is that description? Because if someone that's not familiar with your work, like, I don't know how your albums got in my household, but they were there because, and it wasn't like, I mean, now they have titles for it, soft rock, yacht rock, or whatever they want to call it, but.
Yacht rock, that's good.
I know. Well, it's made this sort of niche comedic, you know, reference comeback thing, but that's made it cool again, like stuff that. Again, a Lester Bangs or a Chris DeGaulle, like I'm better than this type of whatever. Like now, it's worship and revered and those things. But how did you and Peter like figure out this plan to sort of, is it folky? Is it country? Is it blues leaning? Is it, you know? How would you describe the sound that you two molded that I felt really defined the next 10 years of what pop music would be, the California sound, if you will.
Wow. Yeah. I was just playing on the guitar the songs that I'd written and counting on a sort of community of players, Russ Kunkel on the drums, Cooch, a guy named Lee Sklar playing the bass, mm-hmm. Carole King, on the piano. Mm-hmm. I basically was but essentially I was counting on them to be, you know, to do head arrangements of my guitar arrangements, you know, so that you sort of pass it on to another musician, usually a keyboard player, but basically you write out just a simple chord chart and pass it around and count it off, you know. The strange thing about, well, actually, it's still the case. That often the time when the song is recorded for posterity is the first time it's played. You know, that's an odd thing that you
first
don't,
take, yeah.
Yeah, that you don't get to, or even the seventh take. But the point is, you haven't had a chance to tour it for 20 performances and sort of, you know, nail it down and refine it. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought that would be a good way to go.
Okay, so the question I have about Sweet Baby James is, how do you have an active record deal and you're still homeless? Like, or at least I've heard you mention a few times that for that first album, you were kind of just a nomad, like crashing on couches. And how, like, was money just not available back then, or like how did you?
Well, enough money was, you know, and I didn't have a place to stay in Los Angeles, so Peter had a house at the corner of Olympic and Highland, and you know, I just would crash there with at Peter's house while we were recording in Sunset Sound. But I started building a house for myself in I think in 1972, mm-hmm. back in the woods on Martha's Vineyard Island, where my family had sort of fetched up because my folks had taken me there and had taken all of us there in the summertime from North Carolina. My mom was a, she really was culture shocked by moving to North Carolina, and where my dad worked with the University of North Carolina. So she wanted to bring us up north every and try to keep our sort of Yankee roots to the extent we could. So my family all gravitated towards that place as being the happiest place, you know, and we ended up living there. But your question was about being homeless. I suppose it was sort of rootless. No pun intended.
Okay.
Right. Like, not totally broken.
No. Let me clarify. It wasn't like you were sleeping on the street corners. Like, hey, let's help this guy out. Yeah. But I don't know. In my mind, I just feel like there's a certain level of comfort that one has to have, at least I think, in order to find their creative space. Where I've been in a few situations in which, if my personal life is in shambles, that affects my creative output. And so, to hear it described that you were crashing on couches and you didn't have a house, I'm wondering, like, is the duress of the stress of not having roots, pun intended, does that affect your creative output or not?
You know, I never thought about it, but I think you're right. If I can think back to any particular creative periods, it's always been a sort of protected period during the time that I'm writing, you know?
Okay.
And I think you're right. I think it does take that. The songs for Sweet Baby James, that first Warner Brothers album, which you rightly describe as sort of the beginning of the California sound. Mm-hmm. But, you know, back to that question for a second. You know, Peter and I didn't really discuss the sound. We just, you know, as I said, I just introduced the songs to these other players, and we played it the way we heard it, you know, and recorded it. It really wasn't directed in any real sense other than just the sort of template, the form of my playing it on the guitar.
Were you somewhat aware of what the marketplace was and how somewhat different than the marketplace that this output was presenting itself? I'm not saying it was radically, radically different, but, you know, I feel as though...
You know, I definitely distanced myself and identified myself as being apart from music business, you know. To me, music business was still Dean Martin playing at the Sands, you know, in Las Vegas. Well, in fact, Dean Martin was a great singer and did some great songs. But at the time, we identified that as being another generation.
Showbiz.
Yeah,
being, quote.
That's right. Sort of.
So you wanted to avoid the Copa.
Tinseltown. Yeah.
Right.
I swore I'd never play Las Vegas. I got two Grammys. I didn't show up. I said, ooh.
Oh, even the Grammys was like.
Oh, yeah.
That's so funny how each artist. Okay. I'm slowly discovering that every clique or people that I would think were the establishment, they have their. I'm sort of, yeah, I'm above that, which is weird because not like I see you as the establishment, but even now you're saying, like, in your way, like, I'm rebelling against that.
We very much wanted to distance ourselves from it. And I mean, that was the sense mm-hmm. in the zeitgeist in Los Angeles at the time was that we belonged to a different generation. And, the demographic bulge, you know, that happened after the war, that baby boom bulge in the population, when it came to college age, it manifested in a way with FM radio, too. It sort of started to, and the Beatles and Dylan and, you know.
I wanted to ask, I'll let you get to your question.
I just want to say hippies.
But yeah. That's the thing, though.
Yeah.
But I feel, for coming into the 70s, though, what I felt like there was a sort of air, at least with like with Neil Young's after the Gold Rush, that there was this whole disillusionment with all the lofty ideas of what the hippies were trying to present in 67, 68. It was kind of a more of a cynical thing, even though you didn't go that route. Like, was this your response to it? Like, just to be disestablishment, like, you know, I'm a serious singer songwriter. I'm not.
Right. No, that was part of it too, is that there was nothing serious about it. You know, it was like, it didn't have any pretensions, you know. Wow. Was the idea, you know? I mean, yes, I was judgmental of other music, but you know, I realize now that to be judgmental of Frank Sinatra because he's my parents' generation, you know, is that's absurd.
Especially
now,
yeah.
You know, so you know, I've come around to understanding that those. I've got an album coming out of, you know, American Songbook type tunes arranged for the guitar called American Standard, which is also the name of a toilet manufacturer.
But, it is.
It is. On the, right there on the bowl.
I hate you for bringing that up.
Yep.
Next to the Beatles, I'll probably say that soul music interpretations of your songs are probably the most interesting. That's really how I got introduced to it. So,
Isley Brothers, Don't Let Me Be Lonely Tonight.
Dog, I was going to say, my obsession first with Oscar Mayer, I mean, I was three when 3 + 3 came out. Yeah. I thought it was baloney. I thought it was about lunch meat. I'm sorry.
Wait, I can see
what?
That.
Ronald Isley, the way he enunciates his word, don't let me baloney tonight.
Oh, yes, baloney, I got you.
Yes, I... Oh God! Why did I say? Look, Sarah's judging me.
No one knows what bologna is anymore, so
they don't sell that no more.
Yeah, they do.
They have plant-based bologna.
Shut up,
the impossible bologna.
Look,
James, you eat meat?
Huh?
Wait a
minute! No,
sorry,
we're not going to rabbit
you do?
Hole.
Yeah, I
okay,
do.
Okay, I just okay. Would you not think that he was like okay?
My whole point.
Sure.
My whole point, though, was were you aware at all of how radical the soul music interpretations of your songs were? Like, because to me, even though, yes, I love your version of Fire and Rain, but the Isley Brothers have this really notorious 8-minute version of the song that almost wound up on every mixtape I've ever given a girl. So... And on top of that, are you rather chagrined that, for those that don't know the how the song came to be and what it's about and how you wrote it, how almost like Fire and Rain gets, or most of your songs get misinterpreted because we just want to see it through our rose-colored filter? This just a smidgen.
Thought I see you. Thought I see you again.
Wow. Oh, this is my
thought
shit.
Adding.
This is always the second song on every.
I always thought I see you.
Thought it's like a minor to major, like a.
Yeah.
Da, da.
Thought I see you. I always thought.
They won't even get to the lyrics until 4 minutes in. Like,
right.
They just stay here for like 5 minutes. But I was going to say, are you rather chagrined when people take your songs and sort of have it for the wrong meanings? Like, I'm certain that it's been placed in movies and romantic songs. You're like, no, this is about friend suicide and, you know.
Right, and drug recovery. Yeah,
yeah.
It's true. And, you know, but it's the emotional impact of the song that really counts. And I think that's why that song resonated with people because, you know, and I think that the line, I always thought I'd see you again, I think the Isleys are right. That's basically the sort of the emotional core of it. Like,
well, when I've seen it, it's always like someone arrives at the train station too late and the love of their life already like left, or like at the airport moment. Like,
commercials, TV, yeah.
That's
yeah,
right.
And yeah, those two puppies fight, like...
Yeah, yeah. No, it is. It's an emotional package, I think, and it that's what comes through more than the the literal reading of the song, I think, and that's the nature of music. We don't get to decide about it. It's not a cerebral process. It either connects with us or it doesn't, and to a certain extent, to talk about it. Although I talk about it a lot and think about it a lot, but. But that's sort of, after the fact. I mean, the music either, because it's a real thing. It's not, words are, all words represent something else. But the only word that is the thing that it represents is the word word.
Wow. Wow.
Damn.
Words of wisdom. Time to get some from James Taylor.
That's the show, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Wow.
So we put words together to describe all kinds of things, the world, the universe. But music, although it's like a language, we manipulate it like a language, and we use it for. It definitely has emotional. I'm not sure if they're culturally, established, or if everyone in the world hears a minor chord the same way as opposed to a major chord, or but. I do think that there's a reality to it because it follows the laws of physics. An octave is twice the frequency of the octave below it, and half of the one above it, and that the overtone series is a real thing that exists. And so music has its base in it's based in a real truth, and not one that we have to arrive at a consensus about. And that way it hits us directly. And that, that means that it, the cliche, the universal language, but, that's, we were talking about people misinterpreting lyrics and I don't think they really do. I think that, the way a song hits you is probably what it actually has.
They find a common emotion.
So do you feel as though your voice, okay, now I'm going to feel like Chris Farley asking this question. Your voice is really cool, man. but your,
Chris Farley.
Just your, the tone and the sound of your voice is such a warm gift that could possibly... I mean, I'm certain that you could sing Enter Stamman by
Metallica.
By Metallica. And it would just be the best feeling in the world. How did you... I know the answer is going to be like, well, I've had this voice, and it's a gift from God or whatever. People always say to avoid the question, but how did you develop your voice, or what made you sing in a I guess your lower register, like it's a rare thing to have that much impact under a tenor.
That's a really good point. I've never, you're the first person I've ever spoken to who's actually put it that way, and I totally agree.
No, I'm sorry.
I totally agree. The way I look at it is if you have the guitar as your instrument. To sing down in the same range as the guitar itself is like, it's muddy, it's you really wish you could get above it, but I just don't have that range. I can't get above literally above an F, like.
And what was the story that I read about that you injured your voice because you were singing too harshly years and years ago? What does singing too harshly sound like?
Let's not make him,
I don't want him to sing. I don't want him to sing harshly. Okay, I'm just asking,
No, it's I was just singing in a club, you know, 6 days a week, five shows a night, over a loud band without any monitors, and eventually I got a, you know, you get little blisters, I guess.
So what did you learn as a singer, in a way, to learn how to take care of your voice that you didn't do in the past?
It took a long time. And now I find that as I get older, you know, you use it or you lose it. So I exercise my voice every day. That's Tony Bennett told me that.
Yeah.
So you do warm-ups?
Yeah. Actually...
Like of the Seth Riggs variety? Like...
Right. Yeah, I do. And but they're not warm-ups. They're actually like a workout. It's an hour-long process, and I do it every day.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess, yeah, if you're working, that's your working out
it's
in the
like
gym.
A trumpet player and you know, his chops, his embouchure, and his, you know, you got to keep it going.
Okay, can I ask what your daily workout is? Like, what time do you wake up in the morning, and do you set time to create, like, at 6 a.m. when everyone's asleep? Do you write at 3 in the morning when everyone's asleep, or...?
I guess it's just that entertainer's hours. I don't know what's it like for you. When do you wake up? When do you wake up in the day?
Shut up.
That was
first
Steve.
Of all.
I was thinking it.
Okay, as of this speaking, as of this talking, I'm in a relationship with someone who absolutely insists I sleep 8 to 10 hours every night. So
he used to sleep 3 hours a night.
Yeah. Right. I used to be one of those people that was very proud to, you know, whatever.
Sleep is for death.
Right.
That's right.
I was one of those people. That's right. But, you know, I had to get out that situation. No, sleep is the best thing that ever happened in my life, which I'm like kind of mad I missed out on it. But that said, I like, at least preliminary, I'm used to creating late at night.
Yeah.
So I'll say that a lot of my practice was kind of I'll say that 80% of my career was somewhere between 7 p.m. and 11 a.m.
Wow.
Which Quincy Jones has a weird theory about what he calls the alpha state. The alpha state. So Quincy Jones would purposely have his musicians come in around 6 p.m. He feed them a lot of food, give them a lot of wine, and they fall asleep in the break room. Then he wait around midnight, 1 a.m., and wake them up one by one to start playing their parts. The short version is because when you're tired, you can't argue with Quincy Jones. It's like, all right, what do I play? Mm-hmm. But you're not overthinking the part.
Yeah.
He's like, when you're tired, you actually give a better performance.
Yeah.
Huh. Which is mainly, to go back to your first take thing, a lot of times Steve has been like my longtime engineer for like 20 years. A lot of times, I don't want to know when the tape is rolling, because usually when it's like, all right, let's just run it down real quick, and then we'll record it for like the best performance is always when you're not aware, you're not hyper aware.
Yeah,
that it's that.
That
so,
the meter's running, and you're saying, "Oh man, just 16 bars to go." You know, can I? You know that
right?
That's
when
terrible.
Yeah. So a lot of the times, I'm reading something. I can now play effortlessly without. Thinking, you know, and people see me a few times check my phone or eat cereal or while I'm playing. That's how effortless I am as a musician. But I mean, for you, like, if you get an idea, do you always keep a device on you to?
Yeah, I sort of have to trap those song ideas. Sometimes it'll come when you're driving the car. Sometimes it'll come when you're, you know, just often when you're sitting down and just practicing a little. Start playing a little figure, a little wheel, and then you get the thought of a melody and a little scrap of lyric, and you have to put that down so that You know, and sometimes you'll be lucky and that thing will like be half the song, you know, you'll get, and then you, you know, come back to it and write a bridge or, right. But I've always assumed it was because I had to be ready to be on the stand at 8 o'clock at night. Between 8 and 11 is when I was performing, and then it takes me about 3 hours to you know, calm down enough to go to sleep. So, and often I'm on the bus going to the next town, you know. So I just drifted into this thing where I was falling asleep at 2 o'clock, you know. And I just, yeah. And I'm sleeping till 10, you know.
Do you have performance anxiety?
Yeah, I do.
To this day?
Yes, I do.
What does that mean for you? What is that?
So it's not a thing where, yeah, okay. Hi, guys. I seem fine. Like, not, you still have anxiety?
You know, it calms down after a week on the road, but that first night, I'll definitely, I've gotten a little bit more efficient at dealing with it. You know, I don't feel it until about half an hour before I go on, but it's sort of packaged in that time, but I definitely.
Must you be alone to do your, like, how do, what, a half hour before showtime, what are you doing?
That's right. You know, put in contact lenses because I if I have my glasses in the stage lights, it's like it's hard to read and hard to read the set list.
Oh, teleprompter.
Yeah, you know, so okay. But I don't use a teleprompter. I still remember the lyrics, but
you're better man than
I don't know what an artist.
Once you get past like 60 songs, then something's gonna. You're going to forget the second verse to something.
Yeah, so. That's right, and that does happen sometimes. You'll get to the what more typically happens is you'll get to the end of the second chorus and you say, "Wait a minute, was that the first or the second chorus I just finished?"
And you don't know which,
and you're not sure which one it is. Are we going into the bridge or are we going into the next verse?
May I suggest to you pulling what they call a Bobby Brown? Y'all sing it.
Sing that shit, y'all.
I've seen, you know. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, I'm curious about something. So, for the two songs that I got introduced to you in real time, as a 5-year-old in first grade, now I'm realizing that is it the One Man Dog album?
Woo.
All right, so all the songs are what I would call, when I refer to the end, a series or vignettes of shorter songs.
It's like a
Beatles, The End, that's how I refer to it,
right,
or Sweet.
Yeah, it's like a, it is, they're compressed, there's not a one of them that's longer than a minute, and
right.
And they all lead into each other.
But it's really great for kids because one of the first song, all right, the second song I've ever had to perform in second grade was Chili Dog.
Right.
Miss Lewin made us all learn Chili Dog.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, hell yeah, dude.
Oh, like, bless
your
heart. Bless
I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, yo. No, like, but yeah, with what was the reasoning for the way you structured that album?
You know, I realized that I had all of these short pieces, and I just found a way to put them all together, like Little David Play on Your Harp. That's like, you know, I had a dog I lost, and I really shouldn't have had a dog, and I felt bad about it. You know, I was traveling too much to have a dog, and uh-oh. And you know, so
this is why I don't have a dog, Sarah. Yeah,
that's true.
Poor guy.
Before we move on, though.
Yeah, go back.
I encourage every listener to check out One Man Dog. I feel like it's overlooked and underrated, and nobody really mentions it often enough. So, One Man Dog.
You're right, Steve. Right. I'm adding it right now.
Yeah. Why? Okay, so.
I don't know why.
I feel like my history of embracing the wrong albums in everyone's canon. I don't know about One Man Dog because Miss Lewin would play that in second grade, and you know, they're short songs, they're easy to learn. But why, what were your, at the time, you're on Warner, correct?
I was on Warner at that point.
So yeah. What's Mo Austin and those guys saying as far as like?
Right. Yeah, it's
we
it's,
need a single.
Yeah. Well, they Don't Let Me Be Lonely Tonight was a single from that album,
right.
and it did well enough to, and it also is covered more than any of my other songs. So, the thing that was a problem is that if you look at the album and count each one of those little songs, Little David, Chili Dog, Jig, all of those various little scraps, they wouldn't pay for individual songs. You know, they're not going to pay publishing on an album that's got 22 songs on it.
So, right. Yeah. Oh, the rule so we is had still to 12 make, or something.
That's right. It was a rule of 10, I think.
Yikes.
And if you do a cover of someone else's song, they're definitely getting paid. If, you know, you're the one who has to eat
the cost.
Yeah.
I see.
So they just certain songs you get publishing on and certain songs just you don't on that record?
If your contract says that an album shall constitute 10 songs and the record company will only pay for that, publishing on that many songs. If you want to put extras on, it has to come out of your piece. If you wrote the song, it's that's an obvious choice. But if someone else wrote it, then and if you do cover another person's song, you're going to have to pay them. Someone will. I mean, you can't contract yourself out of somebody else's rights. So,
any aspiring musicians, just rewind that and listen to that one more time,
again and again.
Yeah.
Didn't read Donald Passman book.
Yeah. Question. Okay.
So true.
If I'm afraid to ask this question, the myth of what you would call, again, do you call it the Canyon Ranch or just not the Canyon Ranch? There's a specific title for it, the California
Laurel Canyon.
The clique of.
Right.
Of Joni, you, like, was there an actual, were you guys interacting with each other in the way that it was kind of the myth of it, of the stories, or how we see it in our heads, like, oh, okay, you probably hung with Linda, poker at Linda Ronstadt's house on Thursdays, or.
Right. Well, Peter managed and produced both myself and Linda. So I saw a lot of Linda and I sang on a number of her records. Carol and I were sort of in a band together and toured together for a long time. Well,
Carol King.
Carol
so you
King.
Knew her even back in the Brill days or?
No, I didn't know her when she was here in town, although Cooch says that she came down to the Night Owl Cafe and met us when we were the house band down there.
Okay.
Our ill-fated flying machine days, yeah. But
stop saying that. Well, is he aware of the breakbeat on Flying Machine?
I don't know. I didn't even know there was one.
Yeah. Oh, there's a bona fide diamond. Oh.
Oh, you about to tell on somebody? Don't tell him.
There's a well-known breakbeat on Flying Machine record. Oh. I was like, that's part of the hip hop diet. But good,
right.
Ahead. Well, I digress.
But I take the bet. Linda and I had that connection.
Okay.
And Carol King and I had that. Linda runs that. And Carol King and I had a connection. Joni and I were together for a year. We traveled together. We lived together. I stayed at her place in Laurel Canyon, and we also performed on each other's records. She's the background vocals on You've Got a Friend and Long Ago and Far Away. She's, and on a later song of mine called You Are My Only One, mm-hmm. That was Joni and Don Henley singing. But at any rate, Joni was also very personally involved with Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Mm-hmm. Jackson Browne worked with Cooch, with Danny Korchmar in the Section, which was my band, made that Running on Empty album for him. So there was a sense of a group, a sort of community of musicians, and it centered around the Troubadour Cafe, which was which is a dive in L.A.
That's where Donny Hathaway recorded his live album. Yeah.
Where is that?
His version of You Got a Friend was made at the Troubadour.
He skipped over the part where he played on Blue.
Oh, that too.
Just throwing that in there.
Steve's obsessed.
That's Joni Mitchell's album, Blue, for people who...
Fantastic fucking album, Blue.
Yeah.
It is. It is great, Joni.
So, why is Walking Man the one album that... I was about to say Asher Roth. Peter, why he didn't produce that? Why did you go with Dave Spinoza?
It was the first album he didn't produce. Well, you know, I had made already my first four albums with Peter, and I really wanted for one thing, I wanted to record in New York, because I never lived in Los Angeles. I always lived East Coast, and I would stay out there with Peter or at another, you know, place. But I did three albums, one with Spinoza and then two with Warner Brothers staff producers, Lenny Waronker and Russ Teitelman. And those guys who also...
You said that so casually, like, those are gods. Mm. Oh, wait, they were just staff members?
Well, they were staff members at Warner Brothers. And
never... I'm 1 second year old now that I'm realizing that,
that all the good stuff, all the stuff they produced was on Warner.
Which explains why the sound was so consistent, why...
All those things were made at Amigo Studios right there in Burbank.
It never occurred to me that, like, oh, that they were staff producers. And, I mean, I came after an era where labels didn't have producers on standby to take all the artists in. Like, people just chose on their own who they wanted to work with, but... That explains why all the stuff's engineered the same and has the consistent sound. And
yeah, a guy named Lee Hirschberg was the staff. You know, that was the record company's studio. So it was sort of like if you were making a movie on the Warner Brothers lot, it was the musical equivalent of that. So we'd go to I made two albums, Gorilla and In the Pocket.
In the Pocket, one of my favorites. Yes, love that record.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you. Yep. Those were good days. I felt as though I had sort of negotiated the process of being public, of going public. Mm-hmm. I felt stable in my marriage, and I felt healthy and well. And it was just like you show up at the studio, you do your work for a day, you go home. You know, it was very workaday. It was very a stable place to work. Basically working for Warner Brothers, making these two albums, and I think that was a very good period for me.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense for a record label to have staff engineers to have a continuity to their sound. I mean, I think that's a sort of a lost thing now with labels where there's just no.
I came after that era, so. Yeah,
because I'm thinking of CTI and things and jazz labels, and where it's just sort of like, you know, you always have the same engineers and the same producers, and it's the same studios, and it's
branding.
Yeah, labels used to do a better job of branding and having their own studio.
And also, the music was made live. You know, it wasn't all a process of put down an idea with a keyboard and a drum machine, get a vocal on it, and then start making the rounds of people to overdub on it, which is a great way to record, but it doesn't give you the same sound, you know, of if you have a room, you're miking the room, you're miking the players, and they're actually, you know, like that Stan Getz album, Girl from Ipanema's on it. But at any rate, that's a 3-day process. I think Round Midnight, probably also 3 or 4 days. You know, very, very live albums, and that's a rarity.
It just hit me, Steve, that one of our most heated debates ever about music is over Her Town 2. I'm sorry. Exactly. We always have this debate. All right. So.
I see. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah. You explain, Steve, because yeah. I don't know what's going on.
I don't know what's going on. Yeah.
I don't. It's a long story.
I'm afraid to ask.
Right.
Yeah. I'm scared.
Well, he knows what he heard on the radio.
No, dude. Like I live. Dorn and my dad had all pop and soft rock covered. So. There's at least 8 of his records in my house, right? Not in real time. Not like, oh, I'm in the supermarket. Oh, it's James Taylor. That's James Taylor. My whole point was that we were going, this is 10 years ago, where we're just nerding out on James Taylor classics. And in my top 5 is Her Town 2, which was on Dad's work.
Dad likes his work.
Dad loves his work.
Dad loves, yeah, right, loves right, his work. Right. Yeah. That was out when I was like 10. It's my sister's favorite record. So excellent. I'm telling him, like, Her Town 2, and it just, and I was so angry with him for like a week. And I played it for him. I'm like, you're honest? No. I'm like, yeah. And, you know, I'm sorry.
Well, different. All right. Well, I actually have a very similar story because this album right here from 85, that's why I'm here. My sister had the cassette. And brought it on some family vacation, and that's why I know this one back to front, and maybe don't know, you know, a different one back to front, but it's the older sister story, basically.
Yes, both of our older sisters put James Taylor.
That song was a real collaboration, and you know, I wrote it with a guy named. John David Souther, Waddy Wachtel, and Cooch. I think we were all in the room. We were all, you know, staying up way too late. There might have been some substances involved. We ended up with this.
He played. I don't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah.
He came with Stevie Nicks.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. You're trying to tell me the guy that did the intro to Edge of 17? He co-wrote this song.
Yes, he did. Waddy was in the room.
And I get to ask him this question?
I wish everybody could see your face right now.
Yo!
Actually, we should look it up and make sure he... I'm remembering it. But
no! I'm looking right now.
Does it say Wachtel?
Yes! Yeah.
Oh, great. Great.
James was like, I'm right here.
I'm sorry. When Stevie came on the Tonight Show to do Edge of 17, he came with her. And we've been nerding out on him for at least 3 to 4 hours.
He is. That's another. You know, there's so many of these really important musical figures who figure at least as deeply as the person at you know who fronts the band, but you know who like the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
Like the you know that the Motown. House
the
band,
Funk Brothers, yeah.
You know, they all of these people who
TSOP, right?
Yeah,
MFSB. You mean.
MFSB, no. That's what I meant. Yes.
How did you choose these musicians?
You know, for the first album, the Apple album, I just ran ads in the music papers in London. There were two. There was one called New Musical Express, and another one called Melody Maker. Mm-hmm. And we just went to the want ads and advertised for a keyboard player and a bass player. And my friend Joel O'Brien came over to play drums, but ultimately it was like by the time we got to California, I hooked up with Cooch again, and Cooch had been working with Carol,
okay.
So that gave us that basic just two guitars and Carol's piano, and we. Had a number of bass players, but eventually we settled on Lee Sklar. There was a guy named Bobby West who played on Fire and Rain. He played upright bass, you know, acoustic bass, and he bowed it too for one verse, I think. Anyway,
we know Sklar too, you know, Sussudio Sklar.
Oh crap!
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. No, he's. Wow. Yeah, Lee's. Also, you know, one of these deep sources of music, and I think there are musical cultures like in Japan and in Europe and Germany, where people follow who these session players are and understand their value. But we, you know, and particularly back when music was being made live in the studio, you know, these players were, you know, Linda Ronstadt depended on a guy named Andrew Gold as her sort of musical director. And Andrew, you know, is a big part of that sound that she had. And I know you know what I'm talking about, of course.
No, well, yeah, even hip-hop heads, when we collect records, first thing we do is look at the credits. Mm-hmm. Ah, did I not play it on it? Yeah, I'll buy this record. Yeah. Like, see Bobby that. Hall playing percussion on your albums was an instant. Whoa, I know that name. Bill Withers and yada, yada, yada. Woo, woo. We're okay.
So
I asked enough questions. Go ahead, Steve.
No, I just was speaking about collaborations and things our listeners might not know that you, on albums you've appeared on, like just things I wanted to bring up. Steve Winwood's Back in the High Life again, singing background vocals on that song. And
that was a Russ Titelman produced that particular track.
Yeah, and I mentioned you played on Blue. You should really talk about that more. Okay. No, is it true you played banjo on Old Man, Neil Young?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and Linda and I sang on that too. It was a session in Nashville back when Nashville was, you know, in an earlier generation of Nashville, which I really didn't, you know, identify with. The country music at that time seemed like another country to me, you know. It did. It seemed like, and I was raised in the South, so I had a sense of what the line was, you know, what the dividing line was, you know, that kind of Christian gun rack, a cowboy hat thing, you know, that line. Yeah.
We're still living it.
You know. Yes, that's right. Oh, you noticed that, did you, James? Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Oh, how about
news
that?
Flash, news flash.
I'm glad you noticed him, James.
Is that the only banjo you've recorded?
That's right. It was a 6-string banjo, and it so you played it like a guitar, and it just, you know, was stretched across that membrane that a banjo has and made that sound. But yeah.
There's one more collaboration that I don't think a lot of people know about. There's a song on an Art Garfunkel album, cover of Sam Cooke's What a Wonderful World.
Yes, that's right. Paul Simon and Art and I, yep.
Yeah, and everybody takes a verse. It's really cool.
Oh. Yeah, we wrote an extra verse to it, too. Mm-hmm. Don't know much about the Middle Ages, looked at the pictures and turned the pages. Don't know nothing about no rise and fall. Don't know nothing about nothing at all. And that was an extra verse that we snuck into it so that all three of us got a verse.
Yeah, everybody should check that out. It's really pretty.
We will.
I just got stuck on reciting it.
I have a real quick question. Can you confirm something that I've always thought in my head? On In the Pocket, there's a song that you did with Stevie Wonder. Don't Be Sad Because Your Son Is Down. Did Stevie come up with that title?
Yes.
Okay. I knew it.
What's your theory?
It just sounds like Stevie. You know, it sounds like a Stevie sentence.
What Stevie gave me was this this thing that goes like a. Don't be sad, 'cause your son is down. Anyway, that's as much as...
Don't stop! Don't stop!
Teaser.
You ruined it, James Taylor.
Yeah. James, the tear was just about to go over the terrace.
James Taylor, give it. James Taylor, take it away. No, but the thing is that he gave me those chord changes, and he gave me, but on the piano, and he gave me... the title, Don't Be Sad Because Your Son Is Down, and he said, you know, take that and so I
take that song and shove it.
Yeah.
Is this happening?
No. I don't know.
Thank you.
I haven't thought of that song in many a year, but we did it live one year, and it was really, it was great. But, you know, to be able to work with Stevie was, you know, it was one of those things. He sent it over and called me up and said, you know, give it a try, and you know, I'll take the publishing on this one, you take the publishing on the next one, and we haven't got to the next one yet. But every...
Oh, he said I as in him. Okay, got you.
Stevie owes you one.
I know. We gotta go.
I just had a light bulb of a moment. Damn.
He wants to flip some shit.
I know.
You're like, I gotta go. I gotta flip some shit right now.
No, it's just, okay, I have one last question, then I gotta let you go. Okay. I do want to talk about Traffic Jam.
Yeah.
But I also want to ask him, why was it necessary for the book to come out right now?
The
what's more important? All right,
book.
I'll ask you about, yes.
You can ask him off the air about Traffic Jam.
Yeah. Yes, I'll ask you off the air. Okay. I mean, that was some pioneering ass shit.
Okay, yeah.
You were damn near rapping. He was
rapping on that
song. You were rapping in 1977. Okay. Why did you feel it was necessary to share? Thank you for sharing your story.
Yes.
Why did you feel it was necessary to, at this stage in your life, to share that story?
Audible came to me and suggested, sort of through my management, suggested that I do a project of some sort. And
yes.
Initially, the idea was to take five songs of mine, play them, and talk about them, you know, just sort of elaborate on them. And, you know, to the extent that it would take up however many songs were necessary for that chunk of work, which is 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. But when I started talking to Bill Flanagan about getting a script together, he said, you know, why don't we just take a certain that portion of your life that predates your being public, before every, you know, and why don't you just tell that story? So we sort of backed into it a little bit, and
it's a hell of a story.
But why we decided just now, you know, it I took the fall off because I've got kids who are seniors in high school, and they're going to that through that college, you know, admissions thing. And I wanted to not be on the road for that. I wanted to be around. So I just had the time to do it, you know.
Thank you. Yeah. That it was necessary. I appreciate that.
Amir, thank you.
Thank you. Wow. This is one for the ages.
Yeah. Woo.
Is there any last
Thank
words?
You.
Well, on behalf of teams,
did you had a question about Fire and Rain? You were thinking of asking? Or?
No. I had a question about Traffic Jam.
Oh, okay.
Which, what made you even think to approach the song like that? Because, you know, that's essentially hip hop.
You know, it was very...
The 4 or 5 was that bad that day?
Yeah. No, it was written right there in the studio, right in the amount of time, really, that it took to sing the song. It was written.
Freestyling, okay.
Yeah, it was freestyle. And Russ Kunkel took a foot pedal and a box, you know, like and a box filled with packing peanuts. And he attached the foot pedal to the box and played the top of it, you know, with brushes. So it wasn't even a drum. It was like a you know, and Russ...
Making instruments up on the spot. Yes, that's hip-hop. Go ahead.
Russ was you know, he's a very funky player. He's a great player. And you know, we just basically put it together and then harmonized the... The only melody in the song is in the chorus, "Damn this traffic jam, how I hate to be late. Right. It hurts my motor to go so slow. Damn this traffic jam. By the time I get home, my sup will be cold. Damn this traffic jam." And we, you know, it just came out. And it was a very L.A. thing because, you know, if you lived in Los Angeles, you just lived in that traffic all the time. And
well, just because it came out in 77, I was like, well, hip-hop didn't exist yet. I didn't know if it was like post Woody Guthrie, folky, talky thing.
Right,
but,
talking blues like Bob Dylan's talking blues.
Right, but yeah, I Okay, you answered it, and I appreciate that. All right, we got to go, ladies and gentlemen.
White people invented rapping. Just want to let everybody know that.
Shut up, Steve.
Just letting everyone know.
No, man, on behalf of Boss Bill and Sugar Steve and Laia, and sorry, Fonte, you missed one for the record. I'm Babe Bill, and even Zara. Am I missing somebody? Oh, James Taylor.
And Julian.
Julian. Of course, you're family now. Thank you very much.
This has been great, man. Thank you so much for inviting me in.
Well, this is our episode of What's Love Supreme. Whew, amazing. I don't even know how to sign off on my own television show.
Television show?
Yo.
Exactly.
He messed up.
No, I'm playing, y'all. We'll see you on the next go-around of What's Love Supreme. All right, bye-bye. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.